From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Femi Okeh. It's Here and Now. We are keeping an eye on Hurricane Dorian, which could make landfall early Tuesday, somewhere between the Florida Keys and southern Georgia, as a Category 4 hurricane.
And President Trump has declared a state of emergency in Florida. He's also canceled his planned trip to Poland in order to monitor the storm from the U.S. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Rick Klein is ABC Political Director. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Kimberly Atkins is WBUR Senior Washington News Correspondent. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi there.
Okay, so President Trump has struggled in the past to hit the right tone with disaster response. He recorded a video message in the Rose Garden last night.
It's been interesting because it looked like it was going to be a very small storm, that we all got lucky. It missed Puerto Rico. It hit the Virgin Islands, but not as bad as it could have. But it really began to form and form big. And now it's looking like it could be an absolute monster. We're ready.
Rick, earlier this week, the president was essentially taunting Puerto Rico when the storm was approaching the island. Now, does it sound like he's taking it seriously?
Florida is basically his second home. He has two major properties there, Mar-a-Lago and Doral. And as you noted, his idea that he would cancel his trip to Poland suggests that there is a tone that they recognize has to be set here, and he wants to be in a better position from his estate in Bedminster or Camp David, staying closer to try to monitor this. I still think this is a president that is willingly engaged in partisan and political fights, even at times of national tragedy and national mourning. So I wouldn't preclude that possibility, but it does appear that he is trying to take this seriously and trying to corral the forces of the federal government in that direction.
Kimberly, is the president getting better at handling these big potential disasters coming his way?
Well, he's had a lot of them, right? This isn't the first or second or even third. There have been a number of hurricanes, natural disasters, wildfires, and he always seems to turn to the political when pick a fight in the middle of them or to say or do something that seems inappropriate. So being the consoler in chief at this point, being someone who can stand and make Americans feel better that everything is being done is not his strong suit. He leaves that to the folks at the agencies to try to do better. But in this sense, yes, we saw him picking the fight with Puerto Rican officials as the hurricane approaches. But now taking a more serious tone when it hits Florida, it's not just, as Rick correctly pointed out, that he himself has a personal stake in the state with his properties. Florida is a crucial swing state. An election year is coming. And while that shouldn't play a role in how you respond to something like a hurricane, it always does. We saw the president go to Florida after a hurricane hit there before, go to other important southern states. And I think that's part of the calculation here. Mm.
Rick, there was some news from the Justice Department's Inspector General yesterday. A report said former FBI Director James Comey set a dangerous example for other FBI employees when he released memos that detailed his interactions with President Trump to his lawyer, who then released them to a reporter. Weigh in on this news. Did we learn anything of value from this report?
Well, the fact that he's not going to face any criminal charges and the finding that he didn't actually leak any information is critical and something that Comey himself is holding up. The president, of course, is touting the fact that the inspector general did find that he violated department policy. And I do think I think you have to get into his mindset a little bit. And I've been thinking and talking to some people quite a bit about it. This was an unprecedented situation that he found himself in, and he went to unprecedented lengths. That said, there are department guidelines and they exist for a reason. So to have the head of the FBI taking these notes, storing them in non-secure facilities, sharing them with a friend with the hopes later on that they would be seen publicly. It certainly is not a precedent that the federal government would feel comfortable with lower-level employees following. That said, he did not do anything along the lines that the president continues to suggest that he did, calling him a liar and a leaker.
Kimberly, former Defense Secretary James Mattis is being criticized for some of his writing, an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. He wrote this week in advance of his new book. Mattis laments the state of American politics and talks about leadership failure without actually naming the president. Is there any sort of gossip, any bubbling up behind the scenes about Mattis actually doing this, or is this to be expected?
Yeah, Mattis is trying to walk a fine line here. I mean, he says repeatedly that he doesn't want to talk about the president, that he says it's inappropriate and frankly dangerous to criticize a president while he is in office, while he is commander in chief and has the important issues of the world in front of him. He says he won't keep that silence forever. But right now he more or less is doing it. But he is also sort of subtweeting, I guess, in real time, this president talking about things like leadership and values that he makes very clear this he doesn't think this president shares. It reminds me of his resignation letter, which was really one great big subtweet of President Trump to the point that the president didn't even recognize it at first. It was only in the coverage of that letter that the president got very angry and felt very insulted. But I think you're going to see Mattis walk this fine line. It's not going to please everyone. He's coming under criticism for not saying more. Others are criticizing him for saying too much. So I think you'll see him continue to try to take this narrow road for a while.
Yeah, Rick, how do you read into this story? NPR is reporting that Mattis mentions Trump by name only 4 times, and it's all in the prologue's first 2 pages. This is not a guy who's known for wallowing around in political mudslinging.
And Mattis is a soldier and recognizes that as the commander-in-chief, he wants to respect the office. He also wants to respect the people inside the government, including a lot of his friends and former aides and advisors who are trying to make things right and keep America secure, recognizing that there are bigger threats than internal dissensions inside a cabinet. That said, I think the evolution of Mattis is fascinating. This is not a man who was seeking out this appointment in the first place. Mm-hmm. President Trump, by all accounts, became enamored with him during the transition. He called him Mad Dog, which was not even a nickname that Mattis himself liked to use. And then to see the full gamut of this run through the time where he feels disaffected with his time and frustrated. I think it's an interesting insight. Whether it has longer term consequences remains to be seen.
Let's just check in on the presidential candidates, the Democratic ones for 2020. In an interview with The Washington Post, Joe Biden, responding to a story in the newspaper yesterday that describes how he's been telling a apparently false war story on the campaign trail, conflating several incidents of heroism on the battlefield, including the story of a soldier who felt that he didn't deserve a medal because he failed to save a comrade.
I was making the point how courageous these people are, how incredible they are, this generation of warriors, these fallen angels we've lost. And so that I don't know what the problem is. I mean, what is it that I said wrong?
So Biden says that he got the essence of the stories right. Kimberly, is this a problem for him going forward, that this idea that he's maybe telling fibs?
Yeah, I don't think this one instance is going to be make or break. I think if we see over time him continue to flub or exaggerate, it only adds to this idea, this pre-existing reputation he has for committing gaffes and for making mistakes on the trail. But I think you have to also put this in context with the Republican on the other side, President Trump. The Washington Post so far has tallied more than 12,000 false statements or lies that the president has made since taking office. I think that's sort of the backdrop to all of this. I think most voters are not going to walk away from Joe Biden because he got the facts of a story wrong. I think if he continues to own it when he makes a mistake and then talk about the reason as he did in this instance, people will understand the difference between that and the candidate on the other side.
And Rick, isn't Joe Biden sort of taking a page out of Donald Trump's book in this way, he's saying, look, if I make a mistake, the press is going to jump all over me. Like, leave me alone. As long as I get the essence of the story across, the details maybe not so important.
Sure, but I think there's a major difference between the misstatements and mistruths that the president regularly tells and what Joe Biden stands accused of telling in this instance and appears to have told in this instance. President Trump often exaggerates to belittle others, to attack, to make exaggerated points that make himself look bigger. I don't think that's what happened here at all with Joe Biden. And to some ways, he has a point that it shows maybe the worst of Joe Biden with his tendency to exaggerate and fib and sand away some of the details, but also the best. And the story of comforting a soldier who had lost a comrade and did not want that award, that is a real story. And it's been confirmed by the Washington Post reporting. And that speaks to the personal touch that the Vice President Biden has.
Kimberly, next month, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, all on the same debate stage for the first time in Houston. We know that because the field has been narrowed down to 10. What are you expecting for this debate ahead?
Yes, the debate field has been narrowed down to 10.
Excuse me, 20 candidates.
But yeah, this will be the first time we will see Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden side by side, is what a lot of people have been waiting for as Elizabeth Warren continues to rise in her stature in the polls. But don't discount how important it will also be Joe Biden standing next to Bernie Sanders. We've already seen the two of them sniping at each other on issues like health care, primarily. That's a big issue in this election. I think seeing those three at the center of the stage is really going to elevate this race in a new way.
Rick, your thoughts?
Well, it'll be on ABC News September 12th, so I'm excited about it.
You'll be there.
Yeah, I will. And it's going to be a major moment. I think until now, it's a sense of a pregame with this campaign. And yes, there are other candidates who will continue to campaign, but this will be the first time that Democratic voters will have the most plausible candidates in one place at one time on one night.
Rick Klein is ABC political director. Kimberly Atkins is WBUR's senior Washington News correspondent. Thank you both. We're tracking Hurricane Dorian, which is expected to become a Category 4 storm this weekend as it nears the eastern coast of Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis declared a state of emergency earlier this week, and today he told members of the press to expect evacuation orders for some areas very soon.
You will see evacuations. I'm confident of that. But to just willy-nilly, you know, we're not going to be telling every county, tell everybody to leave, because that may create some problems as well.
Georgia officials have also declared a state of emergency in at least 12 counties in the southeastern part of that state. For more, we're joined now by Brendan Byrne, reporter for WMFE in Orlando. Brendan, it's good to have you. What's the latest that you know about where the storm is heading?
Well, it's still uncertain. This has been a very unpredictable storm, but right now we're looking at landfall in kind of the middle of the state, just north of West Palm Beach on Tuesday. But the spaghetti models, as some have seen on television, still haven't really come to a consensus as to where landfall is. So right now all of the state is kind of in the crosshairs of the storm.
How are your local weather forecasters? How are they handling this? Are they serious? Are they okay and laid back? That tells you so much about how seriously you should take the storm.
It does. Florida meteorologists and forecasters are good at remaining calm and making sure people are prepped, but also have the right information. One of our little memes here in Central Florida is a local weatherman named Tom Terry. And we kind of look to his levels of undress to find out how it is. So right now his blazer is off, but his sleeves are not rolled up. So once his sleeves are rolled up, then you know Tom Terry means business and you need to start getting a little concerned.
All right. Keep watching that. Stay safe. Wherever it hits, there'll be high winds, heavy rain. How is Central Florida going to handle that? How have you seen that being handled in the past?
Well, right now, folks on the coast here are starting to board up and thinking about the high winds off the coast and also flooding. Flooding is a big concern for us here. So in Central Florida, we have sandbag distributions. We're getting reports this morning that there are very long lines for these sandbags. You know, flooding is always something we need to worry about with all of our lakes and canals. And also the storm surge on the coast. Also, folks are stocking up because we know that it's not just the storm's impact, but what happens after the storm. And the way this one is tracking, he's moving very slow, and it looks like it's going to be a wind and rain event that's going to knock power out. And as Floridians, we're used to not having power for weeks at a time. So folks are, you know, fueling up their generators, you know, getting all of their non-perishable foods and water. There's been a mad rush for water as well.
Well, the governor, Florida governor, did say there will be evacuation orders. This is critical because those routes out of the areas of danger, they can get jammed up. What's your experience of seeing people leaving in an orderly fashion?
Right. So it seems like Governor DeSantis is kind of holding off on ordering these evacuations just because of the uncertainty of the track. But when the evacuations are in order, there is a lot of coordination between the Department of Transportation. So they'll open up both sides of a highway. So a northbound and southbound highway turns into an all northbound highway. Mm-hmm. They'll suspend toll roads. So you can use our multitude of toll roads here in Florida as well. And a lot of the hotels in the state are offering discounted rates for folks that would need to get out of the area, and they're laxing some of their pet policies so that people can bring their animals with them as well.
Brendan, obviously a holiday weekend. How is that impacting preps?
Well, so what we've heard from some of the hotel folks is that there have been a lot of cancellations at hotels, but also there's been people filling them up with trying to get off of the coast and come more inland as well. I think the extra day off is going to help folks having Monday off, although it looked like we were going to have an impact earlier in the week. So I think, you know, being able to have some of those hotels open up is going to really help folks that are trying to get out of the areas that are going to be impacted.
Sounds like you're going to be in good hands, in the hands of Tom Terry, your local weather forecaster. Watch out for when those sleeves get rolled up and stay safe. Brendan Byrne, reporter for WMFE in Orlando. Thanks, Brendan.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Comedian Dave Chappelle returned this week with a stand-up special for Netflix with a little insight into what it's like to be a famous person right now.
Celebrity hunting season. Doesn't matter what I say, they're gonna get everybody eventually. Like, look, I don't think I did anything wrong, but we'll see.
Why Chappelle has made a career out of divisive jokes, this special is definitely designed to provoke or maybe just make you think and laugh. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us right now. So, Eric, let's get to it. Chappelle jokes about a lot of very sensitive things, including those embroiled in the Me Too era. Here's how he describes himself in this special.
I am what's known on the streets as a victim blamer. You know what I mean? Somebody come up to me like, Dave, Chris Brown just beat up Rihanna. I'll be like, well, what did she do?
So, Eric, I'm watching the audience and they spend the whole time going, and then laughing.
I know.
All through the special.
Well, you know, so Dave Chappelle seems to have decided that since people are going to come after him anyway, he might as well push every button he can as much as possible, proving his theories about how cancel culture is out of control. He's sort of enacting the purest role of the incisive comic. He pushes the envelope, and then when he really crosses the line, we, the audience and critics, push back a little bit. I think he has a point about our cancel culture. People trying to outwoke everybody can be really annoying. But I also think
there was a butt coming.
I also think he downplays how humor can socialize us to accept this view of people that's rooted in stereotypes or that's rooted in prejudiced behavior. And as much as it makes me sound like a school marm to bring that up, I do believe that there's sometimes when he crosses that line in this special.
Let's talk about some of those lines, perhaps for some people who've been watching this special. So he gets his audience to, they are laughing out loud, talking about Kevin Hart's refusal to apologize for anti-gay tweets, which then took him out of the running for being the Oscar host. And then he says he can't help himself from making fun of the transgender community, the LGBT community.
Well, I think this is Chappelle's biggest blind spot as an entertainer. We've got a clip of this moment from his special where he talks about how Comedy Central insisted that he take a gay slur out of one of his Chappelle Show's episodes in the same way that Kevin Hart was ostracized for not apologizing for homophobic tweets from his past. So let's check that out.
What I didn't realize at the time and what Kevin had to learn the hard way is we were breaking an unwritten and unspoken rule of show business. And if I say it, you'll know that I'm telling you the truth. The rule is that no matter what you do in your artistic expression, you are never, ever allowed to upset the alphabet people.
Now, I just wonder how Chappelle would feel if a white comic said that about black or brown people, because I bet there's been a similar joke about the NAACP. And his unwillingness to see the difference between a black person choosing to use a slur about his own people, the N-word, and using a slur to refer to gay people when you're not gay, that seems a little disingenuous to me. You know, there's moments in this special when he's positioning himself as a truth teller, but he's not really telling the whole truth. And I think that's kind of a problem.
So he makes jokes about the opioid crisis. He makes jokes about pedophilia. He makes jokes about doing shooter drills in schools because of mass shootings. Does this allow him to have complete freedom with what he commentates on in our world right now? He's not scared. He doesn't appear to be scared of any topics. Nothing is taboo.
Yeah, and I think that's what people love about Dave Chappelle. That's what I love about Dave Chappelle. He's this funny, insightful dude, and he's a master stand-up comic. He's able to kind of distill social issues and his commentary into bits that are funny and telling all at once, and that's his genius. And I love that about him. There's a moment in the special where he talks about the opioid crisis and observing it from Ohio, where there's a lot of white people. And he makes this joke about how maybe white people should have paid attention when black people were suffering. And he says, now I understand how white people feel because I don't care about white people either. And he's obviously joking, but it's a version of a joke that I actually heard Richard Pryor tell many, many years ago, where he sort of said, maybe the next time you see black people in trouble, you'll try to help. And he's making the same point in a different way, trying to make people feel what that callousness really feels like.
So Eric, it's almost as if Chappelle is ready for this pushback. So he says many times, obviously, I'm joking. And then he also says, right at the top of the special, remember, you clicked on my face. Does that allow him to do whatever he wants with his comedy? Because you don't have to watch his Netflix special. You can watch something else. There are plenty to watch out there.
Oh, yeah. Obviously, you can watch something else. But I'm always reminded of my mother and how she felt about Don Rickles. Now, Don Rickles is a comic that's beloved by a lot of comics and a lot of people. But one of the things he used to do is that when he made fun of black people, he would use this very heavy, thick dialect. And the whole point was that maybe they weren't as bright as other people. And my mother got to the point where she would not watch Don Rickles because she felt like this comic who appeared on The Tonight Show was telling the world that black people were stupid. And there's an element of that to even the best comic. If you allow prejudice and stereotypes to be at the root of some of their jokes, there's always this idea that that can become accepted and normalized. The challenge in dealing with Chappelle is that he's so brilliant that to look at the few moments when he doesn't seem to get it is difficult. But it's important that we do that, that we have the strength to go to even someone like Dave Chappelle and say, you're a genius, but there are times when you don't get it, brother, and you need to get with it.
NPR TV critic Eric Dagans, thank you.
Thank you.
We want to note something that happened in Oswego, New York, earlier this month. It was a reunion, maybe the last, of a group of Jewish refugees who, as children, were brought to Oswego during World War II to escape the Holocaust. The city on the shores of Lake Ontario was the only place in the U.S. to shelter Jewish refugees during the war. Payne Horning from member station WRVO reports.
The day began with church bells ringing at precisely 7:30 a.m. to mark the exact time that the train carrying the 982 refugees arrived in Oswego 75 years ago. The surviving refugees spent the morning traveling to local cemeteries, where they honored those who had died while living at Fort Ontario. The refugees alive today were children when they arrived in Oswego in 1944. They shared stories of what it was like to come to a foreign country, including Simon Calderon.
We didn't know what to expect. The food was good. You know, white bread was like cake.
Henry Brecker says adjusting to life in America was difficult at times.
I remember going to the movies every weekend. I think it must have been Saturdays. It was one way of learning English. We never had any formal language lessons, and I, for one, didn't speak a word of English.
Despite the struggles, all of the refugees, including Bruno Kaiser, who was 16 at the time he arrived in Oswego, said some of their fondest memories are the people here who welcomed them to the community. Residents brought the refugees gifts and invited some into their homes for holidays.
The local people were extremely helpful and positive, as opposed to the anti-Semitism that we were exposed to in our European experience.
Of all the stories that were shared, this one seems to rise above the rest. At a time when the United States and much of the world refused to harbor refugees, Oswego was one of the few exceptions. Children of the refugees, like Calderon's daughter, Lauren Blum, say people shouldn't forget about that, which is more than just history to those who were saved.
A lot of the other relatives didn't. You know, weren't able to, didn't survive. So I just feel fortunate that I'm here because he was able to come here.
Blum brought her children to the celebration. She and her father say it's important to pass this lesson on to the next generation, especially with what's happening today at the southern border.
Those people, they're fleeing because they're not safe, just like my dad and his parents weren't safe. So, you know, we should welcome them like we welcomed my family.
Given the age of the remaining refugees, this is likely the last reunion of its kind in Oswego. It's one of the reasons why local and New York state officials are working overtime to make Fort Ontario and the Safe Haven Holocaust Refugee Shelter Museum a national park. Kevin Hill, president of the Safe Haven Museum, says the lessons this story tells must be preserved.
We need to, you know, learn history so that we don't repeat it. And by learning this history, we can learn, you know, how we need to proceed as a country.
Hill says making this place a national park would do more than just put Oswego on a map. It would enshrine a part of the city's history that, to many of its residents, is a source of significant pride.
It's really built into the fabric of what Oswego is.
For Here and Now, I'm Payne Horning.
It's been a dazzling week for a new generation of young female tennis players at the U.S. Open in New York. 15-year-old Coco Gauff continued her tear yesterday when her opponent's backhand sailed into the net.
And the story of Coco continues.
Gauff is the youngest female player to reach the third round of the U.S. Open since 1996 when Anna Kournikova did it. She's become a minor celebrity after beating her idol, Venus Williams, at Wimbledon earlier this year. Yesterday, she says she's been inspired by all the young American women doing so well in this tournament.
I think we're all just kind of pushing each other. Obviously, when we play against each other, we don't want the other person to win. But literally all the time when they're playing against somebody else, we're always rooting for each other because we just grew up together and we train together all the time.
One of the women Gauff singled out is 23-year-old Taylor Townsend, ranked 116th in the world, but yesterday, in a huge upset, took down fourth-seeded Simona Halep. Townsend was asked by the announcer how she was able to pull off that win.
I don't really think I can say what was going on in my head just because of TV.
Oh, no, we'll bleep it. Don't worry.
But, I mean, I just told myself this is an opportunity, it's a chance, and go for it. You have nothing to lose.
And we'll continue following the action at the U.S. Open in Queens as it heads into its second week. Qantas Airlines is testing the viability of long-haul flights from New York and London to the east coast of Australia. The 19 to 20-hour test flights are scheduled to start in October. The airline wants to know how spending so much time in the air affects the human body. Let's bring in Captain Larry Rooney. He's president of the Coalition of Airline Pilots Associations and a pilot for American Airlines. Captain Rooney, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me today.
And first of all, my goodness, who wants to be on an airplane for that long?
Well, it'll certainly be an endurance test, not only for the passengers, but for the flight crews.
What's the longest flight you've ever flown?
I would say around 11 or 12 hours would have been my endurance test.
Really?
But I haven't done that in a very, very long time. I recently flew back from Prague a week or so ago as a passenger. And 9 hours and change, that was long enough for me.
Well, right. So the people on these Qantas test flights will be fitted with wearable technology. It's going to measure their melatonin levels. The pilots will wear an EEG to track brainwave patterns. What concerns would you have about your own health on a 19 to 20-hour flight?
Well, you know, depending on the pilot's age, hypoxia would be a consideration. Very, very long exposure to very dry atmospheres and high altitude flying. The typical cabin of an aircraft would be equivalent to, you know, Denver plus 1,000 feet or so, but for an extended period of time, you know, rather than the 10 hours that, you know, would be pretty commonplace today, to extend it to double that amount of time. I think that would be something that the people would be looking at that would have the expertise to be able to measure those metrics.
And how many pilots would you need? I guess you'd probably have to take a break to sleep at some point.
Well, that would be a huge component as well. And, I mean, it's uncharted territory at this point. As flights get progressively longer, the airlines have to staff with additional pilots. And that's for, you know, several reasons. The importance is that the most alert crew is the crew that lands the airplane at the destination. Hmm. In order to do that, as flights get longer and longer in length, they keep adding additional crew members so that there's always somebody that is able to get rest. And again, the goal is to make sure that the most rested pilot is the one that completes the landing at the end of this long endurance flight. We have added additional crew members and additional crews, but to get to the length of flights that we're talking now, it's uncharted territory as to how the regulators would require those airplanes to be staffed.
Well, Singapore Airlines has a nonstop 9,500-mile flight from Newark, New Jersey to Singapore. It clocks in at 18 hours and 30 minutes, so close there. Qatar Airways has an 18-hour flight from Auckland to Doha. We've been talking about the crew. What about the passengers? What are airlines doing to keep their passengers comfortable?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for an individual carrier because I'm sure that each of them, you know, would use the accoutrements that they provide on the airplanes as a technique in order to get sales, I would think. But this would be something that a passenger would have to prepare for as well. Because of the long endurance, the way that a passenger would treat a flight to this length in order to be as most comfortable as possible on the arrival, certain things would, you know, as far as their habits, alcohol would be one that would want to be much lower in intake when a flight is of that length because of the dehydration issues that, you know, normally occur on flights of extreme lengths. This one obviously would be the most extreme length.
Well, there's been concerns about deep vein thrombosis on long flights. On these longer flights, you'd have to imagine that even more people would be vulnerable.
Well, and the ability for a passenger to get up and move, too, you know, as we keep cramming more and more people into the airplanes, you know, the ability for them to have free space in order to be able to move around becomes more and more restrictive. It's my understanding, though, that the flights to date, the ones that have been these ultra-long flights, have not been packed with economy class seats. They're more where their business class are better, so that the passengers that are traveling on these extreme long flights have the ability to move around more than they would if it was a domestic 737, let's say.
Yeah, and a lot of these flights are on Boeing Dreamliners or on Airbus A350s. These are big, beautiful new planes. Tell me more about the technology that makes these flights possible.
Well, you know, as technology gets, you know, increases, the airplanes are getting lighter because of the composites that they're now able to build into the design. The engines become more efficient, and as such, they have longer durations that they can obtain because the fuel feeds the engines for longer since they're not quite as thirsty as they used to be. And with that, you know, you're starting to see now these ultra-long flights that are taking place because of the abilities for the airplanes to do it. I think where we have to really look at this is the human machine, the interaction with the human machine, because of the technology increases, we have to ensure that the human machine is up to the challenge as
sure.
well.
Sure, and it sounds like that's what Qantas is doing, but I'm just curious, do you know how much fuel you would need for something like this?
Well, I would suspect it's all that the airplane would hold. But yeah, it would be to the absolute limit. We're talking a 20-hour flight. As far as what that would be in pounds, I'm not sure what the fuel burn of that particular airplane is because they're all slightly different.
You do make a good point, though. Airplanes are designed to have extra gas in the tank, right? So that if something happens, you don't have just enough to get you to where you need to be. I just wonder how much further you could push these planes to go.
Well, that would actually the plan would determine the ability for the flight to operate. The regulators do require airplanes to have a certain amount of reserve fuel available to them when they arrive at the destination. The flight crew, the captain, and the dispatcher who are jointly responsible for the flight would have to, you know, discuss whether or not that particular flight, that particular routing, the weather that would be, you know, that they would be facing on the arrival would allow that flight to operate, you know, nonstop. There's many times where flights that, you know, that could maybe go nonstop if all the conditions were right would have to make a technical stop for fuel somewhere en route just because they couldn't push it to that extent if they needed to pad the fuel reserves for contingencies, for weather, you know, for delays that could happen. So these are all things that go into the flight planning phase, and this would be no different for an ultra-long flight.
Qantas points out that no commercial airline has ever flown direct from New York to Australia. Do you think these ultra-long flights are the last frontier of aviation?
Well, they're the next frontier in aviation, yeah, because there'll always be another frontier in aviation. I think that has shown we've learned that over the years from looking back to the 1920s to where we are today. I think we're constantly improving and you know, trying to get better technologies. You know, certainly what we fly with today on our cockpits are worlds apart from what I started with 35 years ago. So there's many, many changes that will, you know, and I think we'll continue to see these changes as we go forward.
That's Captain Larry Rooney. He's president of the Coalition of Airline Pilots Associations and a pilot for American Airlines. Larry, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me today.
A prominent Hong Kong protester is free now after being arrested and granted bail earlier today. Joshua Wong and other activists were detained in connection with a big protest in June when demonstrators blockaded police headquarters for 15 hours. Emily Fang is NPR's Beijing correspondent. She's in Hong Kong. Emily, tell us more about what happened to Joshua Wong and these other activists earlier today.
They were the targets of a coordinated wave of arrests across the city today. In the case of Joshua Wong, he was actually walking to the metro in the morning when a minivan drove up. Wong was shoved inside and then brought to police headquarters in Hong Kong's Wan Chai district. This is all according to a statement released by Demasisto, which is the youth student activist group that Joshua Wong is a leader in. Around the same time that he was being transported to police headquarters, Agnes Chow, another activist, was arrested in her home and brought to police headquarters. The night before, Andy Chan, who is an independence activist and politician, was also detained at the Hong Kong airport. He had been trying to fly to Japan. All three were arrested for, quote, inciting and organizing an unlawful gathering, in reference to the event you mentioned in June when they besieged a police station. Wong and Chow were let go earlier this evening. They were let loose on bail, and they walked out of the courthouse to a throng of reporters and supporters. And it wasn't just them today. A local lawmaker, a district council member were among the handful of people who were arrested. And they're only one of a handful of about 900 protesters so far that have been arrested since protests began more than 12 weeks ago.
The protests have been getting bigger and bigger. More people from Hong Kong are joining them. So these arrests, what does it tell you about where we are in this situation with people from Hong Kong and battling the authorities?
It means that Beijing is willing to escalate, but the Hong Kong protesters have not shown that they're willing to back down. This weekend was supposed to be a really big political anniversary. It's the fifth anniversary of a decision from Beijing to maintain control over how Hong Kong's leaders are elected. And that decision was the moment that sparked the 2014 Umbrella Movement, a pro-democracy movement during which Joshua Wong, Agnes Chow, Andy Chan, these three activists who were arrested this week, became prominent activists. Of course, those fizzled out, but they've in part inspired the protests that we're seeing here today. And the fact that the Hong Kong government, which is in part directed by Beijing, decided to swoop in at once on these three activists on the eve of this anniversary signals that they're willing to step up their intimidation of the protesters.
So a march was planned for this weekend. Authorities have said this cannot go ahead. What do you think might happen?
The protesters are preparing to hit the streets again tomorrow for a long day, marching in defiance of a police ban on the march and the rally. The question is right now whether things will get violent and when. The pattern so far has been a handful of several hundred or thousands of protesters tend to stay until the very end of the night, and that's when confrontations with police get more violent. The fear, though, is that police, having banned the march, are going to act violently and more aggressively earlier on in the day. But the feeling on the street is this wave of arrests that happened this morning has only galvanized protesters, and the movement is leaderless. So the fact that these a handful of people were taken off the streets of the protest tomorrow has no impact whatsoever on who goes out.
Part of the reason why we're paying attention to these arrests is because Joshua Wong, although you say the movement is leaderless, is somebody that the activists, the protesters, they look to him. He gives guidance. He speaks to the international community. So the latest from him, what are you hearing from him?
He has been released. He gave a speech with Agnes Chow on the steps of the Hong Kong courthouse. Demasisto, the activist group that he is the leader of, also gave a press conference earlier today, and they were defiant. They chanted against what they thought was police overreach and terror, and they encouraged protesters to continue to go out to protests. They also warned that if Beijing is willing to step up intimidation like this and not answer their demands, then protesters might have to take, quote, more radical actions in their efforts to get Hong Kong and Beijing to pay attention.
Emily, so many of the protesters are young people. University starts next week. How do you think that might impact the protests?
I don't think it will at all. Students at schools across the city are staging a mass boycott of classes on the first day of school. I will be following this. And from the beginning of the protests, there was this mentality of mutually assured destruction. You might have seen some of the graffiti quoting the Hunger Games saying, "You burn with us." It's the idea that if Beijing does not listen to the protesters, they are willing to destroy their city, even themselves, in the quest for real democracy. And that mentality has only burned brighter given the arrest this morning.
And can I just ask you this one thing? As a reporter covering this, do you feel the energy from the protesters? Do you feel that this is something extraordinary?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I think the umbrella movement was already extraordinary, and people this time, it's like no holds barred. They just don't see an alternative. They're willing to, you've seen the headlines, they're willing to die.
Emily Feng is NPR's Beijing correspondent, speaking with us from Hong Kong. Emily, thank you.
Thanks, Femi.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Femi Okeh.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.